I don't know if you noticed this act of kindness that Tim did here. He took this cushioned stool and gave it to Stuart. Good on you, Tim. I'm going to take it back, though. Let me start out by telling you a little bit of, partly my dad's story. He grew up in rural southern Manitoba, and as a boy, he remembers when Manitoba Hydro brought electricity to their village. And then as a young man, he got a job with Manitoba Telephones in Winnipeg. While working with the telephone company, one of his jobs was to upgrade people's telephones. Now, if you think back, maybe you kind of picture what you've seen in the museums. Remember the wood boxes, and then they had this mouthpiece that came out of the center, and then there was this hand thing that you put to your ear? That's what he was replacing with a handset, like we have now. He encountered some resistance. People that had hearing aids didn't want their phones changed. And the reason they didn't want their phones changed is the hearing aids at that time had a microphone hanging from the neck and then wires going to the earpieces. So with those old phones, they could take that earpiece and put it to their microphone and talk on the telephone. They couldn't use the new handpieces with that hearing aid. My dad then got a job with IBM, and this is in the early 60s, and he was working on computers that had vacuum tubes. I wonder how many of us actually know what a vacuum tube is. At that time, IBM had come out with a hard drive, and that hard drive had a 4.4 megabyte capacity, but this machine was massive. It was 5 feet long, 68 inches high, 29 inches wide. Nowadays, we carry 4 and 8 gig in our memory stick in our pockets. As a boy, I remember going to the Hudson's Bay Company in Edmonton. Now, I'm not that old that this was the fur trading Hudson's Bay. This was the Bay store. But I was there with my dad, and he was gone to buy an electronic calculator. Texas Instruments had come out with an electronic calculator, and this is the actual one. It was one of the first ones available on the market. He got it on sale for $114. This is in the early 1970s. He now has a mini laptop that he carts around with him. And that mini laptop's got more computing power than any of the Apollo spacecraft ever had. Some of you will remember a world without internet, email, Facebook. For those of you that's all you've known, it's probably hard to imagine what the changes are that have resulted from those technologies. And that's my point of telling these stories. It's to point out how technology has and is significantly changing our way of life, our work, our social structures. How we deal and cope with these large social changes is a challenge we all face. Every aspect of our life is affected. Politics, education, religion, family structures, art, music, economics. Yes, economics especially. Right, Jonathan? Yeah. It's all affected. The second reason for telling you these stories of kind of technology change is to try to give you a way of understanding the Book of Samuel. The Book of Samuel is about social change. Like our world, these changes are a result of advances in technology, except that instead of electronic technology being the driver of changes in our world, it's the technology of iron. The book is set in the early stages of the Iron Age, which is considered to have begun around 1200 BC. Samuel is born sometime before 1050 BC. The title Iron Age simply refers to or describes when iron came into common use. It's not that it didn't exist before that. It's just that it began to come into common use. in that Mediterranean area, for the previous 2,100 years, the common metal was bronze. And compared to bronze, iron has got a whole bunch of advantages. It's harder, it's stiffer. Can you imagine working stone with a soft metal that you have to resharpen every few hits? Iron doesn't have that characteristic. It's hard. You can keep chiseling away at stone. Or how about woodworking? It'll stay sharp longer. Agriculture. You have iron plows now instead of wood ones or bronze that wear off very fast. And more significantly, how about in warfare? Iron becomes the key metal in weaponry. I think as you read through Samuel, there's a number of references that give us a glimpse of this early stages of the Iron Age. Samuel 13, 19 to 22 makes the point that there are no blacksmiths in Israel, only in Philistine, and they are actually the enemy. And because of Philistine monopoly on the technology, the only Israeli soldiers that have iron weapons were King Saul and his son Jonathan. Read the description of Goliath, and notice how special mention is made that his spear has an iron point, and that weighs 7 kilos. I don't think that description is there just to give us a picture of how powerful Goliath is. It's also there to give us a sense of the superiority of the weaponry. In this world of technology-driven change, Samuel is a key character. Samuel is the person who lives through the end of 2 eras and the introduction of 3 new eras. This morning, I want to briefly look at those eras and then how Samuel deals and copes with the major social changes he experiences in his lifetime. As we start to read in 1 Samuel, it doesn't take long to realize that the people of Israel are in crisis. Crisis usually precipitates change. And this crisis is the result of the ambitions of conquest held by the Philistine people to the west of the Israeli territory. The Philistines are a military alliance of 5 city-states, and to give effect to their ambitions, they have a new technology, iron. It shifts the balance of power, and now Israel is under attack, frequent attack by the Philistines, and the Philistines are inflicting heavy losses. Unlike the Philistines, Israel is not organized as a military alliance. Rather, it's a confederation of tribes, which is loosely ruled by a judge and held together by a shared covenant with Yahweh, their God. For the previous 200 years, Israel has been ruled by judges. The translation of the Hebrew word to judge is actually kind of inadequate. The judges did far more than deal with legal issues, as the name would suggest. They were in a position of a ruler. They also provided military leadership. The judges are a little different than the priesthood because it's not hereditary. Each judge was anointed by a god and set aside for some special task or purpose. At the last CWG, we heard the story about Hannah. During Hannah's time, there was no judge, so that position had defaulted to the high priest, Eli, who had delegated those responsibilities to his 2 sons. The priesthood at this time was based in a town called Shiloh, and it was a key religious center to which people would make annual pilgrimages. And that's what we hear Hannah doing, her and her husband, that they made a pilgrimage to Shiloh. Shiloh is also where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, in some type of shrine. As best as I can tell, this sounds like it was some kind of a building, not the tent that we read about in the Exodus story. This is the world that Samuel was born into and that he grew up in. It's a world of tension. Reading through chapters 2, 12, and through to the end of chapter 4, we learn that Eli's sons are corrupt judges, and as a result of this corruption and Eli's weak response to that corruption, there is judgment against Eli's family from God. With the military losses being experienced by Israel, the Israelis are looking to gain some new military advantage over the Philistine army. So they have Eli's sons bring the Ark of the Covenant to the battlefield. The significance of that ark is that it represents God's presence. By bringing the ark to the battlefield, the Israelites are trying to bring the power of God to aid them in the battle. The arrival of the ark strikes fear in the hearts of the Philistines, yet, like wild animals backed into the corner, the Philistines fight ferociously and not only defeat the Israelites in that battle, but capture the ark and kill both Eli's sons. News of that battle travels quickly through the land and to Eli, who hears of the battle, the death of his sons, and the capture of the ark. It's curious how it's not the news of his son's death, but the news of the capture of the ark that causes Eli to fall off his chair and break his neck and die. Eli's death and the capture of the ark signals an end of an era, the collapse of the religious center of Shiloh. And it's a collapse partly caused by the new technology of iron. As the news of the battle spreads, Eli's daughter-in-law hears the news. She is pregnant and then goes into labor as a result of that news, giving birth to a son who she names Ichabod. The meaning of that name sums up how many of the people must have felt with that ending of that era. The glory has departed from Israel. Yet, God's not been sleeping. He's been preparing Samuel to step into that vacuum created by the end of Shiloh. That preparation began with Samuel's mother, Hannah, and continues through Samuel's boyhood and youth. We get a glimpse of some of that preparation in chapter 3, and I'd like to read that chapter. The boy Samuel ministered before the Lord under Eli. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. There were not many visions. One night, Eli, whose eyes were becoming so weak that he could barely see, was lying down in his usual place. The lamp of the Lord had not gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called Samuel, and Samuel answered, "Here I am." And he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." But Eli said, "I did not call you. Go back and lie down." So he went and lay down again. Again the Lord called Samuel, and Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." "My son," Eli said, "I did not call you. Go back and lie down." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord. The word of the Lord had not been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel a third time, and Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am. You called me." Then Eli realized that the Lord was calling the boy. So Eli told Samuel, "Go and lie down again. And if he calls you, say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. The Lord came and stood there, calling as he had the other times, "Samuel, Samuel." Then Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." And the Lord said to Samuel, "See, I'm about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears it tingle. At that time, I will carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family, from beginning to end. For I told him that I would judge his family forever because of the sin he knew about. His sons made themselves contemptible, and he failed to restrain them. Therefore I swore to the house of Eli, the guilt of Eli's house will never be atoned for by sacrifice or offering." Samuel lay down unto morning and then opened the doors of the house of the Lord. He was afraid to tell Eli the vision, but Eli called him and said, "Samuel, my son." Samuel answered, "Here I am." "What is it he said to you?" Eli asked. "Do not hide it from me. May God deal with you, be it ever so severely, if you hide from me anything he told you." So Samuel told him everything, hiding nothing. Then Eli said, "He is the Lord. Let him do what is good in his eyes." The Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word. In this chapter of preparation, the writer quietly introduces a new era. A new era which I think has had a far more profound effect on Israel and us than the coronation of any king has. In verse 20, the writer tells us, Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. With this simple little sentence, the era of the prophet is introduced to Israel. I did a search on the word prophet, and that word is used 173 times in the NIV translation. Prior to Samuel, that word is only used 15 times. The remaining 157 times follow verse 20. Samuel is the prototype of the classic prophet. Prophets like Nathan, Elijah, Elisha, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Micah, just to name some of them. That era continues until about 200 BC with the last prophet, Joel. In addition to these well-known names, we also see various references to bands or groups of anonymous prophets in the early part of that prophetic era. Some of the main characteristics of these classic prophets are that not only do they claim to speak the words of God, they are compelled to speak them. The need to speak is so strong that they can't resist, even if their lives are threatened. The death threats are a result of acting like a conscience to the kings and the people of Israel and Judah. Those voices of conscience tell the people that they are alienating God with their behavior, and that will have consequences, dire consequences. These men also have no hesitation about being political. They anoint people to be kings, and they also initiate coups. It is as if God, in anticipation of the monarchy, introduces the prophet era as a check and balance against the monarchy. Similar to the role of the opposition party in a democracy, the prophets critique and make public the king's decisions, policies, and mistakes. Not surprisingly, most of those kings did not have a good relationship with the prophets. It's these kind of actions by Elijah that causes King Ahab to call him a troubler of Israel. Yet, while we have this impression of the prophets being negative and grumpy and condemning, they are also the messengers who speak of God's love and compassion for his people, inviting them to change their behaviors and restore the relationship with God. At some point following the death of Eli, Samuel becomes a judge of Israel and moves from Shiloh to his hometown of Ramah. It sounds like he's a widely respected judge, one who's obviously empowered by God. Yet, the fear of the Philistine invasions prompts the people of Israel to want to change their political structure to one they think can better cope with military threats surrounding them. The people ask for a king. Samuel seeks God's thoughts about a king, and God tells him, it's okay, go ahead, give the people what they are asking for. With this, Samuel is put into a position where he straddles eras and roles. As the prototype prophet, God has Samuel anoint the man he has chosen to be Israel's first king. By doing so, Samuel becomes the last judge, thus bringing to an end the era of the judges. Samuel's farewell speech is in chapter 12, if you want to look at that sometime. By anointing Saul to be the king, Samuel inaugurates the era of the kingdom, or the monarchy. And that lasts till about 587 with the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. There's one other era that's introduced in the book of Samuel, and I found it quite striking. I stumbled upon it in a Bible footnote. The book of Samuel introduces a new name for God, Yahweh Sabaoth, which is translated as Lord of Hosts or Lord Almighty, depending on your translation. That name first appears in chapter 1, 3, and it's also used again in chapter 4 and then subsequently. The Hebrew word Sabaoth means literally hosts. It's not clear what hosts refer to. It could be the armies of Israel, or heaven, stars, angels. It's not clear. I find this innovation rather puzzling. Why the addition of hosts to the name for God? So far, I've not found a good explanation about that new name. Whatever the reason, though, the introduction of that name changes biblical writing. It's used frequently by the prophets and the Old Testament writers that follow Samuel. My intent with giving you this background is try to give you a glimpse of the huge social changes that are occurring during Samuel's lifetime. Samuel's world and our world have the common characteristics of large-scale social change. What I find interesting is how Samuel navigated his changing world without a map or precedent. If we read between the lines, I think we can catch a glimpse of how Samuel steered through the social shifts in his world. And the best word I can think of to describe it is attunement. Let me explain it this way. If you go to a piano and you gently hold down one key so it doesn't make a sound, then move one octave down and play that note and release it, the note that you're holding down will pick up the vibrations from that one you just played, and it will repeat that note, just in a different octave. And it's just the sound waves transferring and the tuning of those strings. This works regardless of whether you go up an octave or down an octave. In chapter 3, we read the story of the boy Samuel going to bed beside the ark and being disturbed by God's voice. This is a voice he does not know. So he goes to Eli, for who else could it be calling him? It's Eli's wise advice that teaches Samuel how to be attuned to God. Samuel answers the voice with, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." Early on, Samuel learns to hold his key down and listen so that God's note activates Samuel's strings. Did you notice the detail of Samuel sleeping by the ark? The ark symbolizes the presence of God. Up to this point, Samuel had been sleeping and working in the very presence of God and never been aware of that presence. It was not that God wasn't there, it's just that Samuel never noticed it. My guess is that this event and this response to God stayed with Samuel throughout his life. From then on, he was aware, attentive, and attuned to God. Like Samuel, we're often unaware of the presence of God. We're out of tune. So how does one attune to God? Sometimes attunement is forced on us through difficult circumstances, crises that squeeze us under a heavy burden, back us into a corner, and we're left broken and desperate. And out of that brokenness and desperation, we finally are ready to listen to God. But attunement can also be learned through the cultivation of an inner life. For centuries, Christians have been practicing what are called spiritual disciplines. These are practices that believers have found to be helpful in developing a closer relationship with God. Spiritual disciplines are not a magical way to get something from God, nor are they a way to manipulate or force God to act. Neither does the practicing of spiritual disciplines guarantee or prove one's spirituality. If you'd like to learn more about the disciplines, a good starting point is what has become a classic on the subject, and that's the book Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster. There is one copy in the River Library. You might want to take a look at it. It's really good. For this morning, though, I don't want to talk about the various spiritual disciplines. Rather, what I want to do is focus in on one particular practice that I think fits with Samuel's story. And actually, I'm hoping each one of you are going to join me in an experiment this morning. I want to walk us through a prayer exercise. There's no qualifications to participate in this prayer exercise. It doesn't matter where you are with God. You just need to be willing to try it. And the point of the exercise is attunement. Like Samuel, we might not notice the presence of God and hear his heartstrings. So we want to try to develop that attentiveness, that attunement. The prayer exercise is called centering prayer. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it. Often when I pray, my mind is busy with thoughts, plans, fears, hopes. And these all distract me from having a focused or meaningful prayer with God. It's kind of like trying to have a conversation, and I keep looking at my cell phone at all the incoming text messages. Centering prayer is about turning off the phone, putting it aside, and being attentive, attuned to what God has. Centering prayer is actually really simple. What we do is we use a short scripture or a phrase to help us focus. The purpose of that phrase is that when a distracting thought tries to come in, we gently repeat the phrase to prevent that thought from entering in. That phrase could be repeated silently in our mind or spoken out. It is possible that as you repeat that phrase, often a word from that phrase will take on nuances or a special meaning, and that's good. It's probably God's Spirit revealing something to you about that word, giving you some additional depth. This past Thursday at Prep and Prayer, we used Samuel's response as our focus in centering prayer. "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." As I repeated that phrase changed to the plural. "Speak, Lord, your servants are listening." We were praying together. It wasn't just me individually. As you continue to work with, repeat that phrase, you may have a sense of peace or the presence of God. That's what the point of centering prayer is. You may also come to a point where it's not necessary to repeat that phrase, but you may be able to sit in silence, listening, like Samuel. There may also be a time when, like Elijah, you encounter a silence so profound, it speaks. While I found centering prayer to be a sweet way to pray, I've also found that it can be very difficult and challenging. This fall, I've been going through a book that is a 6-week guide to spiritual growth. About midway through, I found I was being dismissive of the suggested phrase for centering prayer. This occurred several times during that week's theme, at which point I realized that there's something else going on, that I had something under the surface that I was avoiding, and I needed to unearth it and deal with it. I had to set the book aside for a few days until I could uncover it, confess it, and repent. The spiritual disciplines have a way of pointing out those kind of problems in one's inner life. The disciplines also provide an atmosphere of grace where you can work together with God towards wholeness. There have also been times when I've been unable to set aside the distractions because I'm stressed or excited. In these times, I found I need to ask God for help to attuning myself to Him and then try again. A variation on centering prayer that I found helpful is breath prayer. Like centering prayer, a phrase is repeated. The variation is that the phrase is repeated when you breathe in, and then the rest of the phrase is when you used when you breathe out. So again, using Samuel's response, as you breathe in, you would say in your mind, "Speak, Lord," and then as you breathe out, you would say, "Your servant is listening." Would you try that with me? So as we breathe in, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." And again, let's try it one more time. Inhale and "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." And exhale, sorry. Inhale, "Speak, Lord." Exhale, "Your servant is listening." That's breath prayer. It's simple. I find that that rhythm of breathing has helped me focus on that, help me focus. Yeah, just gives me a structure to place that phrase in. But also, don't feel like you have to stick to that rhythm of breathing. If you find that you're lingering on part of that phrase or all of it, go with it, because that's a way of entering in, of attuning to God. with this introduction, I hope you'll give centering prayer a try. And that's what I'd like to do this morning. I'd like to take 5 minutes of silence right now to actually try it. For some of us, this silence is going to feel really uncomfortable. There's not going to be any music quietly playing in the background. It's going to be silence. And most of us have to learn to live with silence. But I think with practice, what you'll find is that silence becomes comfortable and even welcomed. I have 4 possible phrases that you could try as one of the phrases to repeat. Pick one that sounds right to you, or if you prefer, choose one of your own. You could use Samuel's response, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." Another suggestion, "Faithful love dwelling in me." Maybe right now, life for you is feeling a bit desperate, and you might identify with the first line from Psalm 61. "Hear my cry, O God. Listen to my prayer." From Psalm 46. "Be still and know that I am God." I'll repeat those once more. "Speak, Lord. Your servant is listening." "Faithful love dwelling in me." "Hear my cry, O God. Listen to my prayer. Be still and know that I am God." One other thing before we start, relax. If you haven't done this before, it's not difficult. It's not a pass or fail experiment. It's simply an introduction to a prayer practice that people have found very helpful in coming closer to God. I'll let you know when 5 minutes is up. So let us pray in silence.